This is episode 7 of Creative Block. My name is Kyle Marshall. I'm the owner of Media Lab YYC, and the more episodes I do of this podcast, the more I realize how easy my life has really been. But we'll get to that. I first met this week's guest, Ernest Barbaric, when he hosted the first ever Pod Summit here in Calgary. I was, of course, interested as I knew that Media Lab was going to be in my future. Podcasts were going to be a big part of it. So I wanted to go and see what it was all about. Pod Summit was such a great time. It's where I also met Karen Unland for the first time. She's the head of the Alberta Podcast Network. I also met so many other great people there, but mostly, I was enamored by how Ernest was tenacious enough to just make the event happen, find sponsors, and create something special. You'll see that in our conversation that there is a lot more to Ernest than just a person who can make events happen. He's also had an extremely interesting journey to where he is now. But before we get there, I should mention that Creative Block is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. You can find all the great shows at albertapodcastnetwork.com. The Alberta Podcast Network is powered by ATB, and on this podcast, I talk with artists and creative entrepreneurs. Well, creative minds need creative banking. That's why ATB created the Branch for Arts and Culture, a branch that understands artists don't live by the rules or standard pay schedules, so you can be creative and not have to worry about your checking account. It's a creative space for creative types, and just one more way, ATB will always be more than a bank. For more information, you can go to atb.com/thebranch. Also this week, we're sponsored by LitFest. Edmonton is the home of Canada's first and only nonfiction festival. LitFest runs October 11th to 21st and features dozens of events with writers from across the country and beyond, all sharing true stories and big ideas about culture, food, science, politics, and more. But really, is there any more than that? Among the writers are award-winning poet Billy Ray Belcourt, musician and documentarian Dave Bedini, and Dr. Brian Goldman of CBC Radio's White Coat, Black Art. Festival passes are only $129. For being a listener of Creative Block, you can get $5 off by using the promo code APNROCKS. That's APNROCKS. Get your tickets today at litfestalberta.org. All right, like I said, Ernest is a really great guy. His story is something you need to listen to. In this conversation, you'll hear about Swiss priests, podcast conferences, and building a robot army. Let's go to that now. So Ernest Barbaric, how are you?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's early in the morning. That's okay. I'm interested in just hearing a little bit more about you. And normally what we start off with here is just letting me know, like, where were you born?
Where was I born? That's a good question. I was born in Sarajevo in what is now ex-Yugoslavia, and I guess what is now Bosnia and Herzegovina. Okay, or Bosnia, I guess. I don't even know what it's called anymore. Yeah.
It's had a few name changes over
the years. It did, yeah.
Yeah. What did your parents do?
So it depends on what age. So I did come to Canada in 1996 after the war. For the folks that may not be aware of it, there was a war in the country where I'm from, and it was a civil war. Everything kind of split up in a bunch of different smaller countries based on ethnicity and a bunch of other things. But anywho, that's a long answer to a short question. So what my parents used to do, my mom used to work in accounting, and my dad used to be a director of this information center for a company that was doing some international investing in energy and that kind of stuff. And then, you know, throughout the years, as we came here as landed immigrants and all this kind of stuff, my mom ended up working in daycare and my dad ended up doing landscaping.
Mm. So was the impetus to come to Canada, the civil wars and stuff that were happening?
Yeah,
there?
So I lived through that for 2.5-3 years. And then we made an application to actually come to Canada and we got accepted. And then that took a long time as well. And then when we did come, we moved to Medicinet first and then to Calgary.
So tell me then about your childhood. Did you realize that hardship was going on, or were you just kind of an oblivious kid going along with what your parents were doing?
That's an interesting question. So You know, well, looking back at things, I had a friend of mine who's actually used to be a commando, and he's Canadian, and so he used to go to all these places like Congo and all that kind of stuff, and he said he would fight the bad guys. And he asked me one question. He's like, "Do you think everybody should go through war?" And I said, "Yes." And he's like, "That surprised me." And the reason I said that is because you then get a little bit of an appreciation of what life is like for people that are not in your shoes. So what my childhood was like was my parents kept me fairly protected from most of the harsh realities, and I took it in stride. Now, where I was going with that is that becomes your reality. So for example, if there was a period of time when our electricity, gas, water, everything got cut off, and we would have to go get water from water trucks that would bring them around. And so you'd carry whatever kind of like water holding thing that you had. And so sometimes my mom would let me actually go and do that. And I was about 10 at the time. And one time I actually got shot at while I was doing that. So, and that was just normal. So like we would, yeah. Okay. And then later I went back to pick out the bullet out of the building. Right. So like, those are the types of things that just become normal because you're acclimatized to it. Is it traumatic or something a little bit later, you know, as you come out of that, probably, you know, you carry some of that with you, but, yeah, it just kind of becomes your reality. And that's the way it is. This is why, for example, when we look at, you know, kids from third world countries and that kind of stuff, they're playing, they're doing things because that's what kids do.
Yeah.
You know, you adapt to the situation and then you just do that.
Yeah. I guess from an outside perspective, it seems tragic to maybe us living in North America, but for them, it is kind of a normal existence.
Well, it is tragic, right? And I think it's the interesting thing is like, you know, as a kid, you just get adapted to whatever the reality is versus, you know, if you've experienced more or less a normal life and then you get sucked into something like that, then it's a different story. So for example, like, I mean, I don't know if there was some kind of like major flooding or any kind of a catastrophe that changes your whole life. It changes your whole perspective on things. And so those are the types of things that can change your perspective quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Are you an only child or do you have siblings?
I have a sister.
Okay. Older, younger?
Older, quite a bit older. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. I'm curious then, as you come over here to Canada and you're now in Medicine Hat. What are you learning from your parents at that time? Like, are there, I don't know, values, things that are still with you that you think carried over into your adult life?
Yes. So the interesting thing is, what am I learning from my parents? Well, so when I came here, I came only with my mom, mm-hmm. because my dad still wasn't able to get out. And so we came here with nothing. And so to adapt to a new country, to, you know, learn the language, there was a lot of different things that came into play. And I was 16 at the time too. So it was a lot. I mean, one thing that I've always, my mom boldly went and did things. And so that's one thing that I still carry with me is first of all, how boldly she made the moves that she made, because, I mean, we wouldn't have been here without her making the decision to leave a country and everything that we owned and everything that we had to come here into a, you know, strange new country, somewhat speaking the language, right, but not fully. And then being able to raise me on top of that to help me go through all of my teenage stuff and that kind of stuff. So that's one thing that I still carry with me for my mom, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about entering into the Canadian school system then. I'm sure that's right. a bit of a shock when you come over here.
It was interesting, you know, because the schools that I went to, so when we went from, so I was in Sarajevo, then I moved, then I was in Croatia for a while and I went to school there. I started going to this electronics school, actually. The school system is a little bit different. And I remember coming here and I was placed in the last half of the second semester of grade 9. And I kind of, you know, picked up on some things. I could speak some English, but not like fully. And I specifically remember this one thing. We were writing exams at the end of grade 9. And I remember asking the person that was kind of going around answering questions. I was like, I asked her what a square meant and I drew it. And I was like, is it a square or is it a rectangular shape?
Yeah.
And I remember they're saying like, well, just take your best guess kind of thing. And I'm like, well, what the hell? Right. And so anyways, the part that was kind of interesting is that the schooling that I went through before coming here was very, hard. And so the stuff that I did in grade 8, I only started doing in terms of math in here in maybe the second year of college, second year of university. So we're doing like, you know, integrals and all this other kind of stuff because that's what was expected of that school system.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, reading about it, it was just a lot more intense. And so coming here was a bit of a change in that regard for sure. Yeah. Especially when it comes to math.
Well, absolutely. Was this something that you were, I don't know, did you become bored with that?
It was easy to do that kind of stuff. Now, the funny thing is, since they put me in the second half of grade 9, in the second half of the last semester of grade 9, the funny thing is because I could read most of things and I could understand most of it, but not 100%. So they placed me in the lower level of classes. So at the time, it was like 10, 20, 30. So they put me in 13 level classes for some things. Because I think they didn't think that I was a good student or something. And then I caught up with English the next semester, and then they bumped me back up to everything else. So I ended up doing math basically. That was like one of the stronger subjects that I had. I ended up doing math basically since I came until I was out of high school every semester because they kept bumping me up.
Oh, gosh. Okay. All right.
To catch up.
So did you go to university?
I did. Yeah. I made a terrible mistake. So this is another thing that was interesting with coming here and not knowing a lot of things. So I didn't know the difference between a college and a university because back home there's different kinds of it would be a third school. So it would be like I guess it would be an equivalent of a university, but there's different kinds. But that's it. So you go to like a technical one or geology or whatever else. And so. The interesting thing is we ended up going to, I applied to a bunch of places and I got accepted everywhere. So I was looking at BCIT, NAIT, SAIT, U of C, U of A, a bunch of them. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to build robots.
Mm, yeah.
And so what ended up happening is that a recruiter from DeVry ended up coming to our house and they sold me on their electronics program. So it was a 4-year degree in 3 years time. Tons of money, and I ended up going there. Now, as you know, they have now shut down most operations. I think
it's kind of like Trump University a little bit.
Yeah, like it was crazy. So
was there an actual like building that you would go to?
Oh yeah, there used to be a school. Like our electronics program was awesome. We had I ended up building this laser communication system for satellites. We had people that were building automation systems and all that kind of stuff. And this is back in 2000.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, like, not to get too nerdy about this, but like, what language you have been coding in at that time?
So we learned assembly, C, C++.
Okay.
So this is like before all the cool languages were in
right.
into play. This is 2000. Mm-hmm. 2001 when I graduated, I think. And the funny thing is, so here's the other thing that actually sold me on university. I ended up going to the school as part of their recruitment process. So on the same day, we went to UFC and DeVry. So I went to UFC. We couldn't find the entrance. Like, and then when we found the entrance, it was so overwhelming and so massive that I was like, I don't want to go here.
Yeah.
And so when we went to DeVry, there was somebody waiting us at the door and they took us in. And the craziest thing that was happening is as we were doing the conversation, there were people coming in from Silicon Valley poaching people out of programs to go to San Diego and Silicon Valley. So I watched one student that was almost done my program get recruited to go to San Diego, get a car, $80,000 signing bonus, a condo, and to live on a beach and to work on this tech startup. Because back then, that was 99. That's when everything was like
everything
was going like crazy. So I was like, this is awesome, right? So I'm like, I'm gonna build robots. It's gonna be great. And then as I got closer to graduating, that the dot-com crash happened, and so then there was not a lot of work for electronics people. Especially because I was in hardware, it's now coming back. But the funny thing is, at the time, there was not a viable place. My first job ended up being, I ended up finding a job through a friend at this one place that was doing electronics for locomotives.
Okay.
And my first job after building a laser communication system for satellites was to mix a rubber compound and pour it into these little cups.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
A little bit of a step down there.
Yeah. That was, I remember somebody was saying like, this is like training to be a doctor and then sweeping the hospital.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yep, that's
good. Oh man. Do you still have that dream of building your robot army?
You know what? I've kind of let go of that as time went along. even when I was in school, I started thinking like, you know, maybe this isn't the best match and I'm not really sure. And so what I shifted to parallel to all of this stuff, even while I was still in school, I actually started building websites. So I've always had an interest in that kind of stuff, but then I started building websites. There was a group of us, there were a group of four of us that built a motorcycle forum for Southern Alberta, essentially, and that blew up. So there was four of us that started, and I ended up doing some design. I designed t-shirts for us and that kind of stuff. And then out of the four of us, I ended up being one of the people that was a little bit more inclined towards marketing, building events, putting together sponsorships. So over, you know, in a span of a couple of years, we ended up doing sort of Groupon type stuff. So we'd get Groupons on group buy on tires and leathers and all this other kind of stuff. And so it was all sport bikes. And so, yeah, like that was kind of the genesis of me leaning into where I am now.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we're of similar ages. So I think it's really hard for a lot of, I guess, younger people to really understand what the early internet was like.
Oh, yeah.
Like back in like those early 2000s, like things were still, like a lot of websites were still in like frames and like there wasn't a lot of like dynamic websites going on. There were a few here and there, but it was just a different world back then.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, like what was your first computer?
It was a compact Presario that my parents bought me, or the family, in grade 7.
Okay.
I have to remember, I think it was like 128 megabytes of hard drive or something.
Whoa.
Like that. Like it was not huge.
That's a pretty impressive machine. So yeah. My first one was a Commodore 64.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And
okay.
So the funny thing is that with my dad being leader of this information center and all this other kind of stuff, so this is like a it was a tech focused back before tech was tech. Mm-hmm. And so I had access to a 286 and I could play Prince of Persia.
Wow,
so
yeah,
that
nice,
was super
nice,
cool. Yeah. And then my dad thought it was a cool thing for get me a computer, so I had a Commodore 64. And I had a Commodore 64, and I'm not sure if anybody's gonna actually remember this who's old enough, but mine had cassette tapes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we would, you know, like load up a game. You would plug it into your cassette tape thing that was connected to Commodore, and then it would load up a game, and then it would take a long time for it to load up again. It was awesome.
My neighbor had the Commodore 64. We never did. I thought it was the coolest thing. It's like, ooh, look, these cassette tapes I can put in.
And then later they came out with the discs with the big floppies, and that was really cool. And then Atari Amiga and all the rest of it. Yeah. So I've kind of been into that world for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, it was a good time really to learn a lot of those different skills. Like this is, again, before any social media, before Reddit, before Wikipedia really even was a huge thing.
Oh, yeah. Like we're talking about BBS maybe. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm trying to think back to my first kind of interactions with the internet, and that would have been, I don't even remember. It was before Yahoo. And I remember I think it was the first modem that I ever had access to was a 14.4. And that was loud. It was crazy slow, and you couldn't really do much of anything. Yeah.
Yeah. So what were you designing in then for websites?
So what was I designing in? So some of it was HTML.
Okay.
The board was built on a PHP, I think it was BB something or other. It was a bulletin board type of software.
Yeah, okay.
So we kind of designed some elements around. You didn't have a lot of options, so it was just kind of like, this is the, you can put a little skyscraper ad here. And so we kind of made it fit. And I don't even remember. Like it was so long ago that I remember. Yeah. I think maybe whatever was before Dreamweaver.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was. There were some programs out there that could let you design.
Yeah.
So you kind of find this new skill then.
Right.
What then interests you at that point? Your dream of maybe building robots has kind of gone away, but now
my dream of building robots was crushed by pouring rubber compounds into little plastic cups. So parallel to that, I'm building all the stuff with the websites and that kind of stuff. And so what I ended up doing is that the company that I was working for got bought and sold. And then I ended up finding another job at electronics, and that company got bought and sold. And so I got laid off like multiple times in this electronics field. And then the last time it happened, I'm like, I'm done. I'm not doing this again.
I guess, that gives you a little bit of a thicker skin for being fired with nothing that is your fault, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a good feeling.
No.
The first time it happened, it was okay because I was with a bunch of my friends and it was just like, whatever, you know, we're pouring stuff into.
Right.
It was, you know, it was actual speed measurement thing. And so essentially what it would go is go on an axle of a locomotive, and then it would use these magnetic coils to count the rotations, etc. So it was like, it wasn't like completely removed. It wasn't it was like I was like, you know, making burgers or anything, which is totally fine. But so anyways, that's the kind of stuff that I was doing on the side. And so the second companies that I was in, that was in electronics, at one point in time, they decided that it would be a good idea for them to rebrand. And I told them, like, I've been doing this kind of stuff for a while, so would you give me a chance? And they looked at the cost of a graphic designer, and they decided that, sure, but the way that I had to do it, it would have to be after work, and I wouldn't get paid for it.
Oh, boy. Okay.
And so, and they bought me, it was Adobe Creative Suite 3 or 2 at the time. I don't remember which one it was. And yeah, so I would stay after work, and I redesigned all the product sheets, all of the materials, all the manuals, all the business cards, the website, the whole thing. And so that made me super happy, because I was very happy to stay afterwards.
Yeah.
And so that kind of gave me a bit of a context of actually doing this in some kind of a work environment. And it was after that, that after that company, you know, laid all of us off, that I was like, well, this is a something that I have. I didn't know you could get paid for it. It was just a thing that I was doing. And a short stint in another company later, where I was, when I actually made the switch into sales, I got recruited by a radio cluster to help them do interactive advertising and interactive marketing, which was essentially like selling skyscrapers and that kind of stuff.
Oh, gotcha.
And so instead of a resume, I brought in, I was like, here's all the different ads and things. So I brought in a brochure of all the different things that I made while I was still doing our motorcycle thing. And they were like, whoa, this is awesome. So they got super fired up. They gave me an offer that blew my mind. I was like trying really hard not to like cackle maniacally when I was there at the time, right? Because I was, I basically tripled my income in one conversation.
Right.
And so that's, and then I made a transition into digital, and that was the first thing that, that was work and something that I was really interested in combined, where I could get actually paid for doing some of the stuff.
What do you think it is that you enjoy the most about designing?
So my approach to design is very minimal and simple. I think that, you know, thinking back to the early time of me dabbling in design, it was more about building something that other people would use and like. And so when we were building the motorcycle forum, I created graphics that would tie everything together. And I would also design t-shirts. And it was really cool to have other people wear the t-shirts that I designed. And the, you know, so this is a really awesome thing that really still sticks with me, is that I had, I made, I think, 3 or 4 designs as part of that group. And then even today, there are people that wear them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're old. We're talking about like 12, not even 14 or 15 years old t-shirts that people still wear today. And it's amazing.
The t-shirts are still 14 years old, or there's like new shirts being made with that 14-year-old design?
There are no, it's done. We did it. And this is, you know, funny. If I think the way that I do things now, I did everything kind of in a very limited capacity, where it was like, there are only this many available. You can pre-order it, and that's it. And after that, there's none. And so nobody else has these t-shirts that I used to make. Yeah, one was Eat Sleep Stunt. I remember that one. That was really cool, because we were all into stunting, and we did these dumb videos of us doing wheelies and things. The other one was, it was another stunt t-shirt. And I remember, and I had this like logo, which was a star and a backward Z.
Okay.
So it was just, I don't know. It was just really cool.
That's awesome.
At the time. Yeah.
So what's always fascinated me about you, Ernest, is that it does seem like you have these multitude of different interests, and you like to pursue these multitude of different interests
all
the time.
Yeah.
Is there, for you at least, is there a hard time to focus on all these different interests, or does it feel like it's all of one thing?
Something actually I've been struggling with for a long time. I've pursued a lot of different interests because that's what keeps me engaged. I've got to a point in the last few years where it's a little bit too much, where I have to really think about, what time I actually do have available and what I'm going to do with that time. And it's impossible to do all the things. So I went very divergent over the last few years, and now I'm trying to bring it all back together. So essentially part of the process that I'm going through right now is I'm actually taking this summer off to revision, refresh, and rebuild my business into something new for next year. And I don't know exactly what that's going to be yet.
Okay. Well, what are some of the businesses that you're in right now, or what have you done here in the past?
So, well, in the past, there's been a lot of different things. So since I started my business, it's been, so I've had my business for about 10, 11 years now. Mm-hmm. It went from, I actually got fired from that radio cluster.
Okay.
And so that day I decided that I'm going to take all of the clients out of radio and turn them into anything else. And so I was really mad. So I decided, and then I started building an agency. And I realized fairly early that I didn't have the capacity to be a manager or a leader. And I had hired someone to do some design, and I didn't like being responsible for other people's work or right. for their income or for their livelihood. And I was fairly young at the time. You know, looking back at it, I might do things a little bit differently now. But so that being said, I realized that wasn't a good match for me. So I scaled back to just me. And then I went from doing this agency business to doing some website building to then getting into social media mm-hmm. and then eventually getting into more digital, which was more all-encompassing. And then from there went into strategy. And then that's where I've been for the last 5 or 6 years and even more. So then I parallel to that, I also started teaching at, I built a social media certification program for my Earl University, digital marketing for University of Calgary. And then I actually started building, I built two different certification programs for the Canadian Marketing Association. Mm-hmm. And all of these have graduated close to like 3,000 people or something like that by now.
Wow.
And one of the best things about all of that is that some of my past students, I connect with every once in a while, and they've moved, they've changed careers, they started businesses, they're successful. They found things that they were interested in through the, I wouldn't say through the teaching that I've done, but at least helped through some mm-hmm. of that. And that was absolutely amazing. So there's the teaching, there's the speaking, there's the strategy work that I do with companies. I built this thing called a strategy camp, which is a 3-day, essentially all hands on deck. We get all the management teams
right.
and marketing teams into one room, and we chart out a marketing, a digital marketing strategy. I built a podcast conference. I've done some podcast workshops. I tried a few times doing some public workshops, which has been interesting, and that's something else I'm going to lean into. And right now I am learning how to be an executive coach. So I'm actually taking that certification. And I was going to take some time to learn Python this year, but I think I'm going to focus on writing. So actually, I've signed up for Skillshare, and I'm taking up basically taking a whole bunch of writing courses on there. So writing essentially for me is in terms of communication. So podcasting, blogging for myself, and then also helping clients do the same thing. Mm-hmm. I was actually looking at that masterclass with Malcolm Gladwell. That right? They're pushing that pretty hard,
like super hard, like every social media platform. Yeah. Like, oh, a masterclass by this person.
Yeah, it's like it's Gladwell again. So I was looking at that, and I'm not 100% sure if that's the best match. Some people say good things, and some people say that it's kind of like meh. So we'll see.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, you have a lot of things then at this point. I want to lean in just a little bit on the podcasting that you're doing, since now this is a podcast itself. I know you've done a few podcasts in the past.
I have.
What have you learned about podcasting after having done it?
So I've ran some kind of a podcast for, I think, 7 years now. Mm-hmm. What have I learned about it? I think is done is better than perfect. So I think that's a good way to look at it. I am a perfectionist.
Okay.
And that can be a really debilitating mm-hmm. way to be, where you're essentially, you know, I would record myself and I would say, and I'm gonna be like, God damn it, I have to go delete everything and start over again. and then I would get so self-critical that I would grind myself down to a stop. And I think there are quite a few people that feel the same way, because it has to be, you know, it has to be good, it has to be perfect. So that's one thing. Equipment doesn't matter as much as people think it does. I am a total gear nut. I have so much stuff that it's ridiculous. It's actually ridiculous how much video and audio gear I have. And at the end of the day, I gave myself a challenge a couple of months ago, the second last episode that I did. I was like, I'm going to use the cheapest equipment that I have access to, software, everything. So everything all in. So microphone stand, software, everything I was using was maybe $80 in total.
Right.
And I was like, I'm going to see if I can just use this and see what happens. And it came out really, really well. And so the funny thing that happens is you go through this, I kind of draw this bell curve. It's a process of adoption where you know, you start off with a cheap piece of gear and then you're like, I want better and better and better and better and better. And then you get the best. And then after you get the best, at least this is the process for me, then you start realizing, well, you know, this is really good, but I can do it with like less expensive equipment.
Exactly.
Because by
yeah.
this point in time, I've built up the knowledge of how to do EQ, how to do compression and that kind of stuff. And so essentially what ends up happening is that you can sound just as good on a crappy microphone.
Yeah.
Then, you know, with $16,000 worth of equipment in terms of the content that you portray to your audience. So that was another big learning.
Yeah, that's great. Why a conference? Why Pod Summit?
Oh, right. So Pod Summit was, so here I'll tell you a little bit of a backstory, I guess, to Pod Summit. So it's an idea that I've had for a little while. So I had this podcast called 26K, and I wanted to be better at it so that the people that are listening would get more value from it. And 2 years ago, or I guess a year and a half ago or so, I got accepted to speak at a TEDx. And this was something that I've wanted to do forever. I didn't think I was ever actually going to get to do it, but I applied, and a friend of mine, so my friend of mine who happens to have been a commando in his past life,
he's now
a business coach. I was like, man, I don't know if this is a good thing. I don't know if I'm going to be good enough. I don't know if it's, you know, if the topic is good enough. So he goes, well, you might be dead on January 21st. And I'm like, all right. So, you know, fair point. So all of us got in. And so after the second I walked off stage of TEDx, I just kind of collapsed. And then a few minutes later, I was like, well, now what? Mm-hmm. This was the big thing that I really wanted to do. And now that it's done, you know, what do you do? And then a few minutes later than that, I'm like, well, I had this idea for a podcast conference, so I'm going to see if I can pull that off and see if it happens. So basically that was the impetus of it. Basically the idea was I wanted to see, it was a test for myself to see if I could put together an event that would be valuable for people that anybody would come to. Mm-hmm. And then I was looking at it saying like, okay, so I have a podcast. These are all the things that I want to learn. And I don't have the bandwidth to go into the States to, you know, to go through some of these other podcast conferences they have. They're very expensive, takes a long time, which is great. I think the conferences that they put on are super fantastic. But I was like, why don't we have nice things here?
Right. Yeah,
and
exactly.
So that's where the first one came into play. So that was last year. And I started selling tickets, and I said, basically, if I sell 10 tickets, I'll run it. Mm-hmm. And then we got sponsors, Shure hopped on board, Adobe hopped on board. As soon as I kind of shared in a couple of places, all these sponsors wanted to come on board. So that was awesome. And then we partnered up with Work Nicer, which was really great here in Calgary. So they let us use the space. So it was way better than I ever would have expected. And I put so much work into it, and it felt awesome. Like I would work, you know, I had a 2-year-old, so I would work on her naps when she would go to bed, and I would just work at this thing. I was doing like video and all sorts of different things. And it was just really, really exciting.
Yeah.
And so that was from my own personal benefit. But then, you know, the people that came to the conference, we had people come up from the States, from Saskatchewan, BC, they got a lot of value out of it. And so there was this one lady in particular that came from Boston who started a podcast as a result of
That's
the podcast
great.
Conference. And then she got into Time Magazine with it. And
oh, wow.
it led her to all these other new opportunities. I think she's shutting it down now a year later, but she's blasted through, I think, 100 some episodes and it worked really well. Yeah.
Okay. I love hearing those success stories.
That's what keeps me going. Yeah. Yeah.
I think even just tying this back to the education that you're doing or the teaching that you're doing,
right.
This is something that I kind of come to the realization of here in the last couple of years, where I think it's really important, or at least for me, it's really important not to just like, you know, cover it or hold on to this knowledge that I have. It's nice to be able to give that off
right.
to other people, because there's returns that you get on being able to give that knowledge to other people.
There is. So when I looked back at, I had a bit of a trend. So to kind of connect a couple of dots here, the podcast that I first started with was called Marketing Uncut. So it was me and a friend of mine who now happens to live in Saskatchewan, Kevin Hayes. And so we would talk about marketing things, and it was a branding marketing thing for us to do. So the funny thing about that was Marketing Uncut, because we wouldn't cut or edit anything out.
Right.
So if Kevin or I messed up somewhere halfway in the episode, I'd be like, damn it. And we would stop and they would delete everything and start from scratch. So yeah. Be like, hey, this is Kevin and this is Ernest, da, da, da. And we would do that. So that's where my podcasting journey really started from. And then I had a couple after that. So what happened with, there was a big transition point in 2012. My mom passed away from lung cancer. Okay. It was an 8-month battle, and that really impacted me at a very, very deep level. And so I started questioning everything. And so I've later come to understand what that is. But later that year, I ended up reading this article on Wired, I believe, or TechCrunch, actually, about this gentleman called Sir Ray Avery, who's a New Zealand inventor, amazing person. And what captured me was the title. He said, "You have 30,000 days of life to live." That's where it started from. So the grief and the impact of my mom's passing is what really brought that to my attention. And so I read through it, and essentially it tells a little bit about his story. So he's invented these incubators that can work in brownout conditions. He's invented technology that helps people with cataracts in third world countries. And he's done some really, really, really amazing things. And he talks about, with the knowledge of the limited amount of time that he had, he would prioritize different things. Mm-hmm. And so that really resonated with me. So then I did a calculation based on my family history, and my number was 26,000.
Okay.
And so that was the podcast called 26K, which is now defunct. And the idea behind it was I would talk to people who do meaningful work in order for help me discover what that is, mm-hmm. and then hopefully help other people find that. So that's where it really started from. And then after that podcast, I kind of fizzled out, but I had some incredible interviews, like multiple time New York Times bestsellers and all this kind of stuff. And then, and some interesting people, like, for example, there's this lady that, her name is Karen Gimbel, and she used to work for the Gimbel Eye Center and then for the Gimbel Foundation. And then at one point in time, they sold everything, her and her husband, and they just lived out of their car for like 3 years.
Right.
Just super interesting lady. And then they came back, and she started this art gallery in Black Diamond called Blue Rock Gallery.
Right. Yeah.
And she's just an amazing person. Just like listening to her talk about her life was so enlightening for me. And I wanted to do more of that. So, and I forgot what the original question was, but those were some of the transformative things that changed the direction in my work, in my writing, in my podcasting. So the podcast that I have right now is Art of Meaningful Work, and it continues down the same path where I'm trying to figure out, talk to interesting people, do some research on my own, do some of my own studies, and try and figure out how do we get to fulfilling meaningful work and what that means and what is the process of getting there.
Yeah, I think that's admirable. I'm curious how you find the people to be part of the podcast. Like, how do you reach out to this multi-time award-winning author?
So when I reached out to them, it was a couple of years ago before there were so many podcasts and before it was this popular. So it was a lot easier. But here, I'll give you an example right now. So I'm on Instagram, and sometimes I follow people. I'm into stationery as well, amongst others. I restore straight razors, and I collect fountain pens and all this other kind of stuff.
Are you into typewriters at all?
Photography? No. For whatever reason, I never really resonated with typewriters. But the interesting thing is that I follow people that do these incredible journals and that kind of stuff. And so there was this one person in particular that we connected on Instagram, and I'm like, he's just an interesting guy. He posts these like crazy, interesting photos. So we're like, where are you taking these shots from? So he would take a picture of his journal and coffee and like some crazy, awesome mountains and a meadow in the background. What is it? So it turns out he's in Switzerland. And so that was fine. And then now I just posted a couple of pictures of my process of doing some journaling and where I got to. And he commented on it. I'm like, you know what? Like, I kind of feel like there's something here.
Yeah.
So I messaged him, and it turns out he's a priest is in Switzerland. And one day a week, he goes to prisons to be a priest. It's not a priest. It's something else that's similar
like
to a priest.
Like a prison chaplain or something
like
that.
Not a chaplain. He said he has a name for it. I don't remember what it was anyway. But so I was like, would you, like, this is the thing that I'm building. Would you be interested in hopping on with me? And he said, yes.
Great.
So that's a totally weird, obtuse way that I got a really interesting person to be part of the podcast.
Yeah. So it's just the matter of asking.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, so reach out, ask. I think building relationships is really important, especially now because there are so many podcasts. And the other thing that's happened lately is that, and I'm not exactly sure why, but I get pitched on people wanting to be guests on my podcast quite a bit. So the last interview that I posted was with this really interesting guy who used to be a criminal defense lawyer, and he went through a transition somewhat similar to what I did. And then what he decided to do, he said, like, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to die. And he spent 2 years actually volunteering at a hospice, which is incredibly hard. So when I heard that, that was like just an incredible moment of connection. And so it was his people that reached out to me saying that he wrote a book called Meaningful Work and kind of gave me a bit of a background. So I'm like, I get pitched on this stuff all the time, but I checked him out and he's legit. And so then we had this conversation. It was an incredibly powerful conversation. I haven't published anything since because I didn't know what to do after that. So that one came to me. Right now, actually, I'm actually in conversation with the founder of ConvertKit to get him on the podcast as well, because they just changed their company into something new, and it resonates with meaningful work. So it's just kind of interesting. I think by publishing some of these things, you attract the right people.
Yeah.
And what's really important is doing it for the right reason. And for me, it's about helping people find meaningful work.
Yeah. You know, you were mentioning when your mother passed away that you started questioning everything
right.
that you were doing. Were you able to ever answer that question? Like, what is the purpose that you're striving for?
So not at that time. I answered that question for myself this last year. Mm-hmm. And so I've been, it was probably, I go through these existential crises on a 2 year cycle, 3 year cycle. So my business always kind of changes as a result of that. But I've been stuck in this loop for probably 3 or 4 years now, trying to figure out what am I doing? What's the point? What's the purpose? And I went through earlier this year, I actually went through a bout of depression and sometimes I have anxiety, and I don't think I really have a lot of issues with depression, but mm-hmm. this winter, so it was around February, I was in a really dark place. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is for me, I start researching things. And so I ended up coming across a few great studies and a book called Lost Connections by Johann Hari, in which he talks about kind of the causes of depression and how to fix it and why, and you know, why we are the way we are. And then through all of the other research that I've done, through all the books that I was reading, I ended up coming across this one interesting statement, which totally makes sense in hindsight. And that is, and this is amongst a whole bunch of other things, and that is, if you don't think that the world is going to be better a year or 3 years down the road, that leads to depression. Because then what's the point, right? If you don't think things are going to get better, if things just continually get worse, you lose your drive, you lose your passion, right. There's no reason to do anything. And so out of that space, about a month later, I was doing journaling and really doing a lot of hard introspection and this reading of these journals, scientific journals, research studies, et cetera, et cetera. My why, which I try to formulate before, really comes down to, and this is my internal why, this isn't mm-hmm. something I share with people, is to make the world a better place tomorrow than it is today.
Right.
And so if anything that I do helps make that happen, it's the right thing to do.
That's great. That's a great mantra to even have. Yeah. It's like, I want to make tomorrow better than today.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come here this morning and talking with me. The last thing we'll leave off here with is there any advice you would give to that creator, the creative, the entrepreneur out there? What's the advice that you usually give to people that are trying to pursue this?
So, well, I mean, we danced around a lot of different things. We didn't talk about a lot of business or entrepreneurship or creativity stuff. So the way that I'm going to look at it now is I would say one of the things that's really important is to be aware of why you're doing this in the first place. So some people do it out of necessity. Some people do it out of some kind of a higher calling. If I were to, looking back through my research, and I've interviewed over 100 people around the idea of meaningful work, there are three things that will make your work fulfilling. So one is being very clear on what your values are and what you actually stand for. Mm-hmm. And there are a few exercises that can help you determine that. I think a lot of people just pick words without a lot of context. Words don't even matter. It's the context that you give them that actually gives you meaning. And then how are you living by those values?
Right.
And then having a hierarchy of them to say, like, is family more important than work, or is work more important than family? Because that is going to make your decisions a whole lot easier and clearer. The second thing is to know what your raw talent is. So there's a difference between talent and skill set. You can be really good at videography, but you might have a real talent for writing.
Right.
And so discovering what that talent is incredibly important. One kind of a shortcut way or a hack to start discovering some of this work is are two things. So one is to take the StrengthsFinder test, which will give you your five themes that you can work with, and you can actually start doing some more discovery on that. And the second thing is to watch what you actually find really easy and people find really valuable.
Mm.
So for in my business, I've really punished myself over the years because if anything was felt easy, it didn't feel like it was worth it. I didn't feel like I was providing value. And so I would make it harder for myself over and over and over and over again. So essentially what I've come to discover is that I have a certain talent that only I uniquely have in the way that I uniquely approach things. And so now I'm just letting myself do that. So what comes easy to you that people find valuable, and taking the StrengthsFinder test. So that will help you start discovering what your talent is. And the last thing, that I'm calling service at this time. So finding a group of people who you want to benefit from your work. Every single person that I've interviewed that does fulfilling work, it's never, ever about them. They're not doing it to, you know, money is a happy side effect of doing, of performing service for someone. And so some of it can be non-paid, some of it could be paid. But so if I look back to the last person I interviewed, Sean Askenozy, who spent 2 years working in a hospice, he didn't work there. He didn't get paid for it. It was volunteer work. And it's out of that that he ended up building a chocolate factory now. and he takes, so the way that he's doing it, he takes kids from his local area. They go to Honduras on trips. He works with farmers on sustainable farming. He's built this business out of fulfillment. And what he told me is that he makes a fraction of what he used to make as a criminal defense lawyer, but he is so much more fulfilled and happy.
Right.
And I think that is the most important thing.
I feel like I should be writing all this stuff down. Ernest, is there a way that people can follow you online if they were interested?
Yeah, for sure. So you can find me at ernestbarbaric.com. That's my website. That's getting rebuilt this summer. And I'm on Twitter at ebarbaric, on Instagram at ebarbaric. I actually post some kind of cool stuff there. So you can actually get a look at all the different podcast gear and the journaling and the stationery and all that kind of stuff. And then, so those are probably the three best places to get in touch.
Cool. Well, thank you once again.
Yeah, of course. This was really great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there you go. Thanks again to Ernest Barbaric for taking the time to talk with me. It looks like his website that he talked about at the end has gone live. So go and visit ernestbarbaric.com. That's ernestbarbaric.com. Thanks for listening. Creative Block is available everywhere you can get podcasts, so if you've been enjoying the conversations, tell somebody about it. We'll be back again next week. Have a great day.